From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this month when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, made an announcement that shocked people around the world. The couple said they plan to step back from royal duties and become financially independent. The couple will drop their Royal Highness titles and split their time between Canada and the UK. When making their announcement, the couple cited the British tabloid's treatment of Markle, including some racist comments, as one of the main reasons they are seeking distance now. Harry, who is sixth in line to the British throne, expressed fears that history was repeating itself when it came to the press. Of course, his mother, Princess Diana, was killed in a car crash while fleeing a paparazzi 22 years ago. And Harry said Meghan has, quote, become one of the latest victims of a British tabloid press that wages campaigns against individuals with no thought to the consequences, a ruthless campaign that has escalated over the past year throughout her pregnancy and while raising our newborn son, end quote. So what's next for the Duke and Duchess of Sussex? And how are not only Brits reacting, but for me, my bias is on the table here. I don't get that we're in 2020 and we still have divine birthright, you know, the succession of kings. It's hard for me to get my head around, but there's a lot of debate in Britain about it. There's a lot of debate around the world about it. We're going to talk about it this hour with people far smarter than me and British expats and also a woman living in London. We're also going to talk a little bit about Brexit, and we'll talk about sort of the state of not only Brexit, but let's get all British culture this hour. Can we do that, Mark Brummett, Professor of Hebrew Bible Interpretation at Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School? Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
I said before the program began, I don't even know if our panelists agree or disagree. And you said what?
I don't know if I agree with myself, even. My head has several opinions at one time, but that's quite usual.
That is. That's partially why you get invited.
Thank you. And you said getting British, but I see no tea.
There is no tea here. That's correct.
Faux pas.
Colin Coffey is a local small business owner and a regular on these parts. But you're always so kind to clear your schedule for us. Thank you for being here once again.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
And Colin, unlike Mark, definitely agrees with himself. I feel like you're pretty self-assured.
Well, I think we've already had some conversations where I said, you pressed me on which way I would have voted to leave or remain.
Yeah.
And I said, I still don't know.
Oh, boy.
So,
well, this
yeah.
is going to be interesting. Isabel Davies is a Brit living in Rochester here. Welcome. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. Do you feel like you can agree with yourself on these kinds of issues?
I do not feel strongly in any way about it. And if I examine my feelings, it's, you know, much like Mark. Yeah, my opinions are quite limited, although I have a lot of things that I enjoy discussing about it.
All right, well, it's great to have you here. And on the line with us is Sarah Audu, who's a Brit living in London, who has joined us previously, is back with us. How are you, Sarah? Thanks for taking the time.
Hello, hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's
I'm good. Thank you.
Nice to have all of you. So let me just, I guess, start by asking, does anybody want to try to disabuse me of the notion that there's something strange or even vulgar about a divine right of kings in 2020? Mark Brummett?
I don't know if that is even the mechanics of it nowadays. I don't know if anybody's thought like that.
Well, you still have to be born
that.
In it. Like, you couldn't be sixth in line, I don't think. You still have to be born in it.
Patrilineage is not necessarily divine right in the way that it once was. That was toppled with Charles I's head.
Well, you're
somewhat.
Just questioning my phraseology, which I think is a
well,
just
but
a
no, it carries that. Yeah, I mean, I know what you're meaning, but it carries divine right of kings carries quite a whack.
Okay.
Which I don't think the royal family has done in the last century, really.
Okay, fair enough.
There isn't a political welly there. It's,
What is it a right to? You know, other than an income, you know, what is it, what do people gain?
Well, I think when it was used then, it was the right to rule. So, and the model is biblical from the Psalms, that whole kind of Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anointed Solomon king, which isn't in the Psalms. But then Psalm 2 is something that was very popular for translation in the 16th century. How you translated it, whether you were a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian during the Reformation, meant you either supported kings and bishops or you didn't. And Psalm 2 talks about God anointing God's anointed one to be God's agent on the earth. And that was presumably used as a kind of coronation psalm. And so that's really the thinking of the divine right, that it, you are God's agent on earth.
Well, so if we've abandoned at least the biblical roots of this, we still have a monarchy. And I guess maybe I misspoke here, Mark. Let's just say the idea of a monarchy feels a little clumsy.
Yes.
Okay.
It does.
Is it clumsy to you?
Yes.
Do you enjoy it?
Yes. No. No, I do not. I have to say that I am not. And really haven't been since about 1977 a monarchist. And that was the year of the Queen's Jubilee, Silver Jubilee. I was very excited and drew a lot of pictures of Anne Boleyn. I wasn't really getting what it was about. And, you know, it was probably the last time I was particularly flag-waving.
Okay, so let me ask all four of our guests, because Mark's saying you haven't been a monarchist in a while. That essentially just means whether you support the continued notion of monarchy at all, right? Taxpayer-supported, et cetera. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, Colin, are you a monarchist?
I've always been a Republican politically, but I think over the time, a constitutional monarchy, you know, it costs us $300 million dollars a year or pounds, I can't remember, to keep the monarchy. But then we don't have to pay for presidential elections. We don't have to deal with all of that. You know, it's just the Queen signs the legislation. You've got the House of Commons that is in charge, the House of Lords to consult. There's a certain efficacy, that would be the word, I think, in a dignified constitutional monarchy, and also its tradition. I think it's Windsor Castle is the longest continually occupied royal palace in the world for nearly 1,000 years now, and there is something about the pageantry and everything else. And even my Irish mother has come around to the Queen a little over the years, just simply from her longevity.
I can't let you get away with just its tradition. I mean, in my family, it's tradition that the men don't wash the dishes. There's a lot of dumb traditions that should be jettisoned.
Can I say something about tradition?
Jump in. Yes,
on, Sarah,
please.
So in respect of tradition, it's not only tradition, but it's an institution. So what you're saying about your family is a tradition where we change traditions. I think what we're saying is that we have an institution, which is a monarchy, and we advocate change within that institution, but we don't agree for it to be abandoned, you know? So that's, I think, the difference between tradition and, you know, the fact that this is actually an institution.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough here. But Isabel, would you like to see it abandoned? Are you a monarchist?
I am not a monarchist. I know, I'm really enjoying, Sarah, that you are. Wonderful. I see the benefit of having a monarchy. I don't quite understand the mechanics of it, but I see the benefit of having something that allows us not to be... For me, I always felt like the prime minister was less than as big as a president would be because of the existence of the monarchy.
That's actually an interesting point, because we're in a country here, and again, this is not a commentary on just the current president, but in especially the last two presidents, a concentration and deployment of executive power is sort of increasing with velocity here. Mm-hmm. You're indicating that that's sort of just checked by the existence of the monarchy at all.
Well, I think these guys could probably set me right on that, but it's really just from a kind of, I've not thought about this a whole lot, but when I do think about it, this is what comes up. I believe there are countries where they have monarchs and presidents, so there it gets a bit confusing. The second point that I feel very strongly about that is kind of connected with the monarchy, but not entirely their realm, is... the challenge in Britain of our elites being stuck. You know, we have an elite that is, you know, in all areas, in sports, in the media, in politics, in the civil service. There are like 80% of the people that have the influential positions are from like seven schools, independent schools that we, I don't know if you guys went to independent school, I certainly didn't. It's not something that the layperson can access. So when I think about the monarchy, I think they do represent part of that problem, even though they are somewhat disconnected from it. I wonder if we didn't have a monarchy, if we would then also start to question this other institution that prevents us from becoming a more kind of equal society in terms of influence.
Well, I'll turn to Sarah here, but I will also remark, this is why we should have British guests all the time. You have this sort of self-loathing and self-deprecation in which you can advocate a position and immediately talk yourself out of it and talk yourself into the good evidence otherwise, whereas in this country, we just dig right into a trench and never come out. Sarah, you are, as I understand it, a monarchist. So what do you see as the greatest benefit of the monarchy?
Okay, so for example, I've traveled to other parts of Europe where I've gone to visit, palaces where kings and queens used to live. And I think what I see in England is life, you know. We have a living monarch, so we don't have an empty Buckingham Palace. So you go to, Prague, you go to these places, they've got these empty castles and, you know, if we don't believe in the monarchy, why don't we just abolish these castles and just build a modern hospital? But we keep these castles because we couldn't, they couldn't afford their monarchy. But we, the British people, can afford our monarchy. We do want our monarchy. And we do want life in these palaces that otherwise would be empty. Because we're not going to abolish them. We're going to keep them because of their historical value, because they were built thousands and thousands of years ago, a bit like the pyramids. You don't just demolish them. So why don't we have living people living in them? It gives us joy. It gives me joy. I love to see the Queen. And secondly, as a person who wasn't born in England, who came as a child, when I came to England, the Queen was here. So I don't want to change that. I met her here. I love it. I just wish they'd be a bit fairer. I don't think they did right by Meghan. I think they should have been a bit more sort of, because the press were really nasty. But, you know, they'll change. We like the monarchy.
Well, and this is where that point is interesting, Sarah, because I think, at least here in the United States, we've kind of had this bifurcated idea that, well, if you're a monarchist, you're upset with Harry and Meghan, and if you're not, you probably say good for you. Whereas, Sarah, you, as a monarchist, are saying, you get it. You understand why they've done what they do. What is your sense for whether this is meaningful or not? Because for someone like me, it looks meaningful, but then he's sixth in line to the throne. He's never going to be king. So is it as meaningful as it maybe at first appears?
I think it is, and I'll tell you why. When Princess Diana died, I, along with practically everybody, I went to my local station because as soon as we heard it, we went to sort of Kensington Palace. And as God is my witness, you know, there was a flower shop in the station. Everybody was, it was like we were robots. We were just going, buying flowers. We went to Buckingham Palace. We went to Kensington Palace, laid down flowers. I'd never seen anything like it. I don't think I ever will. Now, that day, if you were there, anybody that was there outside Buckingham Palace that day, the Queen refused to fly the flag at half mast, yeah? I was there. And I tell you something, if they didn't fly that flag at half mast, yeah, we were going to go and get the gates down Buckingham Palace because there was enough of us. There was no army that could have stopped us. There was a lot of us, you know. So then, you know, the Queen, we respect the fact that she's changed. She accepted Meghan. That's a huge change. This is a woman that didn't want to fly the flag at half mast when Diana, who is a blue blood, she's one of them, you know, died. And she took Meghan in. You understand what I'm saying? There's a huge change. I've been here witnessing it. You know, when Meghan got married to Harry, as God is my witness, everybody of my generation, of my color, of my ethnicity, we were extremely happy. It was like, yeah, we're accepted. It was a big thing for us, you know, and we're a bit disappointed that, you know, the Queen didn't, you know, stand up a bit more. And we're a bit disappointed that Prince Andrew is still HRH and not Harry. But nonetheless, we think that the Queen made some generous statements and, you know, she called them my family, they're welcome. So, you know, I believe in peace and love and I just hope for the best. And I love both the Queen and I love Harry and Meghan. good for Meghan. Good for Meghan for saying, you know what, my happiness comes before any tradition, any culture, any whatever. Good for her, because that is the modern woman. So that's what we've got, a mix of the old and the new, and we just have to navigate through it, which is what we're doing.
Mark Brumman, how significant do you see this split?
Okay, now I need to fill the space with noise for a minute, don't I? And this is one where I don't have a strong opinion. I entirely get it. It's to be part of the royal family is not to have much agency. I think it is to have a lot of privilege, but it's not to have much agency. And one of the things which has happened with the loss of an idea of a divine right of kings in that sense, and the monarchy becomes a constitutional monarchy with absolutely no political welly, and if you try and speak out on any opinion, it's actually a very dim view is taken of it, that you are utterly constrained, therefore, in many ways. So I can imagine the frustration there. And then not only are you utterly constrained, but you're constrained in how you then deal with the press. And the press can have a heyday with you, and you can't really, in the traditional model or the classic model that has been set by Elizabeth II, is that you don't speak out, you never complain, you never explain. And clearly that doesn't really fit well with a contemporary sensibility, the sensibility that's now coming along in Harry and Meghan's generation. So I totally get why they want out of that life. And yeah, I have. It's interesting then watching the kind of the terms on which they exit. Interesting. I was listening to something a couple of weeks ago, talking about how in the US the royals are really seen as celebrity figures.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, there's the whole thing that our taxes pay for them. So the people feel that it's not just a glamorous lifestyle, it's a glamorous lifestyle they pay for. So even if you're a staunch royalist, you have opinions on some of the decisions which are made about buildings.
Because that's my money, darn it.
Precisely. So this is one of the things that you do see in the British press is an opinion on the royals over the spending of tax. And when Windsor Castle burnt down 20-odd years ago, probably more now, and taxpayers realised they were paying for a lot of it, and that the Queen herself didn't pay tax, that law shifted in response to public opinion. And so I think that's, for me, the interesting thing, is that clearly the monarchy is going to have to mutate and evolve to modern sensibilities and the sensibilities of Meghan and Harry's generation. And that is going to be interesting, because where is the accountability in terms of tax, press?
Sure. But Colin, when I look at just the idea of agency and perhaps what Harry and Meghan are staking out for themselves, ostensibly for others in their own family, it strikes me as unlikely that we would ever see a Will and Kate do this, because, well, we still have this thing called succession. And again, Harry wasn't going to be king. If Will and Kate did this, it would be just, I can't imagine the level of uproar. It would be an entirely different level, would it not, Colin?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think if you go back, you know, often people are saying now what Harry and Meghan are doing is absolutely groundbreaking. But I think if you just go back to the idea that Queen Elizabeth basically had to ask her son and her daughter-in-law to get divorced, she'd prevented her own sister from marrying a man who was divorced. Her uncle was forced to abdicate because he wanted to marry a woman who'd been divorced. But yet, Diana and Charles were told by the Queen, look, you need to get divorced. That was a far bigger bombshell than anything Harry and Meghan can do. Mm. And I also think that, you know, Meghan is a foreigner. I just read today that she's abandoning her attempt to become a UK citizen. simply because you have to be resident for so many continuous days, mm-hmm. and she's not going to meet that requirement. But I think sometimes we just forget about how incredibly successful Meghan Markle was as a business person and as an entrepreneur. I mean, she was making $500,000 a year. Yeah. She had her own website, making $80,000 a year in commercial endorsements. She's very, very smart. And I think going back to the point of the difference between monarchy and celebrity, she's had a taste of what it's like to be a celebrity without all of the nonsense and restrictions that being a royal has. So as long as they pay for their own, as long as they pay for their own life and they carry on being successful, I think most people's attitude is good luck.
Well, everyone wants to jump back in here. Mark Brummett, you're
just a quick
all of a sudden
comment is just something that he said that prompted me is one alongside that this is going to call or signify changes that are going to have to happen within the institution in its funding and things like that. It's the next wave of changes. Another part is that it is interesting that it's happening alongside the Brexit. And that the two of them are really extraordinary challenges to a British identity. One, in terms of Britain's relationship to the rest of the world, and particularly Europe, of course. But then within it, one of the grand symbolic institutions is itself, which maybe Brexit is supposed to be in some way protecting, that sort of sense of Britishness, is then also being challenged from within. So I think it's symbolic. It might not be constitutionally a challenge because it's not Harry and it's not Will and Kate, but it is symbolically challenging to a real identity crisis broadly across British culture, maybe.
Well, and so before we kind of get to Brexit, which we will in our second half hour, let me ask all of our guests, and I want to start with Sarah, but I want everyone's take on this. All of a sudden, there is much more of an international conversation about race and racism in Britain because of now that the whole Megxit thing is happening, there's a lot more of a review of what Meghan Markle has gone through. From a racist brooch, which I did not know was a thing, to all kinds of, obviously, media coverage, to comments that family might make. You know, the New York Times, the Daily, they did a whole half hour on what Meghan Markle has gone through just recently. And so for those of us kind of looking at it in the sense of a parallel, this country is grappling with race, sometimes very clumsily, probably there's probably often very clumsy because it's difficult, but in ways that are a little bit more roiled and not royal, R-O-I-L, roiled, mm-hmm. post-Obama presidency during the Trump administration. And I'm wondering if there is a benefit to sort of seeing certain things at the surface so as we can, so you cannot deny them and they must be dealt with, or do things get overblown? Sarah, how do you view what the Meghan Markle story says about race in Britain and sort of public perceptions of race?
I think that we know that there's a problem with race in Britain, and I think that Meghan really, really highlighted it. And when I said that I think that the Harry thing was kind of revolutionary, what I mean in that sense is that the Queen accepted that there's racism. So for us, you know, one of the things about racism is how people gaslight you and they deny that it's racist. But, you know, even Priti Patel, who's our Home Secretary, she said, she's Indian. She said, no, there's no racism. So that the Queen was able to accept that, yes, Meghan has been going through racism. That's a change. So it's a good thing that we're talking about it. It's come to the surface. And, you know, there's also been problems with the Brexit racism. And, you know, it's a good thing to talk about. It's a start, because one of the things with racism is that sometimes people don't actually understand that they're being racist. Sometimes it's also fear. So it's sort of, you know, sometimes people confuse race with religion. So that's kind of a good thing to bring to the fore. So now we're also talking about, you know, who are terrorists? You know, why are people feeling threatened? Why are people suddenly sort of voting parties who, you know, I nearly voted Nigel Farage, you know, Brexit party, and I'm black. So there's an issue with racism, and I don't know what we're going to do, but it has been talked about.
Okay, Isabel.
I'm wondering if I might answer the previous question first.
Go ahead.
Just because I have never in my life thought about statesmanship or stateswomanship, statespersonship. When I was listening to the impeachment coverage, the witnesses for the first part of it, I suddenly started to feel this like, oh, wow, this feels like people willing to come forward and speak. And Fiona Hill was one of them, and she's British. And it was kind of an uplifting thing to listen to these, I think, courageous people. And when I think of statespersonship, the monarchy is sort of required to do that. They have to live in that world of that is different from the rest of us. We've already spoken about that. I don't know that it's possible, and I think Meghan and Harry tried this, but I don't think that it's possible to continue to live that way in the face of what they were experiencing. We haven't really talked much about the tabloid press, I think because there's been so much coverage of it, but it's hard in this country to imagine the tabloid press and what it is and what it does. It's also been my experience, and I'd be interested to know Sarah's experience of this. Where I grew up, I don't know if it's true for the rest of Britain, but sexism is a bigger thing than it is here. And that's partially through the tabloid press. We have these topless ladies in the newspapers. I don't know if Americans know that, and that's just seen as part of life. You know, kids see that. It's a newspaper, like a regular newspaper. And I just don't know how... let me just say what I was going to say, which is that, especially I feel for Meghan, there is this aspect of racism, there's the sexism, there's just general kind of awfulness from the tabloid press, and I don't know that it's possible to maintain statespersonship. Mm-hmm. In that environment.
But has her decision, her and Harry's decision, mm-hmm. at least prompted more of a reckoning, or is that just too sanguine a view?
I have no idea.
I think it has. It has. It's caused conversation. It's caused people to understand, for example, what white privilege is. We've had some very strong, you know, BAME journalists, you know, talking back to Piers Morgan, putting him in his place. You know, it's been excellent. It's been an excellent exercise on behalf of ethnic minorities. She's done a huge favor. She's a person who's walked in and said, look, I earn $500,000 on my own. I don't need, you know, to take this. Even if you're my employer, I don't agree that you should abuse me. I'm not going to be part of this. And, you know, I happen to be black as well. You know, and everybody like me, every black person is like, good for you, Meghan. And you've brought a conversation. You've given me the guts to be able to say to my white friends who are a bit privileged or whatever, look, you're being privileged here. Like a white friend said to me that, oh, I get racism in Mexico. So I said to her, well, that's like God and the devil having a talk. And God is, you know, white and the devil is black. And then God is whinging, oh, they do it to me too. And then the devil is saying, yeah, they worship you and they throw stones at me. So that's something that I couldn't have said last year. My friends would have not talked to me. But this year I've had this called gaslighting. So she's done us that favor.
Colin, what do you make of that?
I mean, really, they are they're an incredibly privileged young couple. They have enormous opportunities. I mean, some of the best, there's been some really good comedy about it as well. Jonathan Pye is a fake journalist who does a stand-up routine, you know, just skewers the royal family whenever he gets a chance, and, you know, talks about, you know, the, you know, Ginger Toff chooses Nan over wife, shock, horror. Chooses wife over Nan, shock, horror. You know, and do we really care anyway? These are, it's like a soap opera, only it's a sort of sanctioned divine soap opera with sort of monarchy thrown in and ceremonies. But if Meghan and Harry go off and make a new life, that's wonderful. That's good for them. And I agree with what Sarah said, that I think my impression is that women of colour in the UK do not get the visibility. And when they do, people like Diane Abbott, the Labour Party's deputy, just gets torrents of racist abuse. So tremendous strides forward have been made. Like I think Sarah was talking about how the Queen was very open about welcoming Meghan and acknowledging that she's experienced racism. There is progress there, but there are troglodytes out there still, and with their nonsense. And so, unfortunately, someone like Meghan becomes a lightning rod for it. But the vast majority, I think, of British people are very pro her, not against her because of her race, and really happy that Harry met the woman that he loves and he's got a nice child. And they want to go off and live outside of the public, you know, spotlight. So as long as they pay for themselves, good luck to them.
Yeah, I will say, Jonathan Pye, the clip that you shared before the program was funny. I didn't know if I could pull a quote because I can't tell if people are cursing when I'm hearing them. I don't know all the curse. I don't know what translates per se. So I couldn't pull any. But it is very funny. Mark Brummett, how do you view the question of what this has done to a conversation about race?
In Britain, it's always also allied to issues of class and economy as well. And some of the, and that's not to in any way deny its racism, it's just a sort of the shape of it is some of the racist rhetoric in Britain over the last 50 years has been they come over here and take our jobs. Kind of language, and
which included the Irish as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely, various ways. But then, I there's this idea of new money and vulgarity, and not being appreciated within the royal family. So there was a thing I saw a while ago where there was a picture, a front page tabloid picture of Kate. Just resting her hand on her abdomen when she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And the headline was something like nurturing the heir to the throne kind of thing. Yeah. And then a little later when Meghan was doing pretty much the same thing, it was very much flaunting.
Narcissist Meghan flaunting. Yeah,
vulgarity, all those things. And so it becomes a kind of a collection of different... the royal family is really an object of Freudian transference in that we throw all our various demons and underlying fantasies on them.
Why does Kate, Mark, get a different headline than Meghan gets?
Well, I think it's race, is income, part of it. Right. Nationality, the fact that she enters the family with oodles of money. It's a combination of these things, and also the point that we all have to say there isn't some simple answer. I don't know,
but race is a component of it too.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And Sarah, you've seen those headline comparisons. I mean, what Mark is talking about is one of what turns out to be many very close direct comparisons that sort of even for the tabloids look cynical, which is a hard thing for tabloids to appear. For them to be caught.
Avocado or something, one of them.
That was just one example.
Yeah, avocado.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is that they've made such fools of themselves because the comparisons are so obvious. I mean, I do law. So normally when you do things like that, you do it in ways where you have to get forensic people to find the evidence. But this is so blatant, you know, the avocado comparisons. It was so mean. I think they've done themselves a disservice. I think that in 2 to 3 years' time, there won't be, you know, these tabloids won't be around. The people that also listen to those people and those tabloids, they're the ones that are sort of with poisonous minds and, you know, they're just not going to be around. I mean, you know, they're the benefit clause.
You're waiting for a die-off, are you? You're waiting for a die-off, Sarah, are you? That's very, very Darwinian. A Darwinian solution.
But that's... Well, sort of. But you know what I mean? I mean, literally, the tabloid press, they're just not going to be there. They're not relevant anymore. People are using Instagram. And I think that most people are going to just realize that the tabloid press spread hatred. And we just don't want any more hatred. Mm. I think the government, everybody is trying to tone down on the hatred. We've had so much hatred. So there's a lot of money going to, you know, from churches, there's a lot of publicity trying to sort of calm people down, stop hating each other. And the tabloid press, I think, is going to find itself out of everything. Piers Morgan is so bitter because Meghan wouldn't talk to him after she married Harry. So, you know, get over it, Piers.
I would like everyone to get over Piers. That would be fun. I'm late for our only break of the hour. And as we go to break, just a little bit of some of the picture as we talk about Meghan and Harry. By choosing financial independence, Meghan and Harry would no longer receive money through the sovereign grant and would be able to work professionally at their choice. They are worth an estimated, by various counts, $30 million or so already. They would repay the sovereign grant expenditure for the refurbishment of their UK home, Frogmore Cottage, which will continue to be their family home in the UK. That was a renovation of about $3 million US of taxpayer money. That's according to royal accounts revealed last year. So, yeah, they're going to be fine. Of course they're going to be fine. But it is a very interesting development to talk about not wanting to rely on that anymore. So after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about Brexit. So we've talked Megxit, so let's talk Brexit. You just heard Sarah Audu, who's a Brit living in London, on the line with us. And in studio, Isabel Davies, Mark Brummett, Colin Coffey are all here. Don't know how we convince them to give us the afternoon, but we're grateful for that, and we'll talk to them more after this. Coming up in our second hour, live coverage of the impeachment trial in the Senate on WXXI. If you want connections next hour, we are live with a new conversation about the candidacy of former Vice President Joe Biden. He's routinely described by voters as the safe choice for Democrats. Could he be the best choice? We'll talk to some of his biggest supporters about that. Next hour on WRUR FM 88.5. All right, before we get to Brexit, I expect that right now my colleague Beth Adams is listening. And Beth, I'm outing you here. She loves British culture. And really, you can pretty much intellectually seduce Beth just if you've got a British accent. Now, Isabel's got sort of this combo accent, so I don't know if you're the full, you know, 100% for Beth. But it's enough for her to be convinced that whatever you're talking about is erudite, it's impressive. That is a form of privilege.
Absolutely.
Do you own that?
I do. I absolutely own it.
That's so funny.
When I first got here, it was so interesting what people would say about the kind of things they thought I should do with my life here, because all they could hear was this and make an assumption about it, which we do in Britain as well. So I, in Britain, people assume that I'm quite posh, but I'm not. But I sound like I am. We immediately will be able to tell what somebody's class is from because of their accent.
Yeah.
Here, I think I don't know if you guys don't sound as posh as I do, so I don't know if you get the the privilege that
are
I
you
do.
Are you saying I'm common?
If she isn't, I am. But yeah, you're right, and I have to say that I've noticed that if you say something nice with a British accent over here, people think you're being slightly sarcastic or they're not quite sure. But if you can say the rudest thing and they think it's adorable.
You can get away with so much.
Yeah, right? some of the words I've dropped in surprising places and like, oh.
And Colin, that's why this was a brilliant move for you to come here, because in the UK, you are common. You know, you're just not impressive. Here, even though you're common, you're British, so you're elevated.
Yep, you're right. You're right. My parents were Irish immigrants, and my mum was pretty much illiterate when she came to the UK. They worked in construction and in the National Health Service. I went to a great university on a full scholarship, a beneficiary of the Labour government's policies of opening up access. But over here, there is a flip side to it. I always tell my husband, he says the same thing, you know, oh, you could say anything and get away with it. And my response is, people don't listen to me though, Michael. I'm just a voice. They don't actually care what I'm saying. They just hear the voice.
They're just excited that you're saying it.
I want to be heard. I'm more than just a voice.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Colin. I'm so sorry.
Reduced to an inflection.
It's a burden. It's a burden.
This is a level
nothing
of
more than a flat vowel and a foreskin.
Oh my God.
This is a level of intersectionality I did not expect us to alight upon. But that's why this could be your last show. But yeah, anyway.
You said keep it light, Evan.
We're trying to keep it light. And Sarah, do you see, if you just come to the United States, the power that you'll have just upon landing, it's really remarkable.
Yes.
just remarkable. Now,
well,
go ahead.
Hear that Trump is deported as well. Trump doesn't like people coming in to your country.
He's significantly less interested in that than his predecessors. I think that's probably fair. By the way, I should also say, I recently heard someone, after listening to a podcast of an economist who happens to be from the South, who has a very heavy Southern accent. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine said, that's the smartest Southern accent person I've ever heard. And I said, people can be brilliant with Southern accent. What are we talking about? So there's all kinds of privilege and assumption and stereotyping. So as much as we're laughing about this, that is a thing that probably infects all of us. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Brexit. And, you know, Mark Brummett sort of gave us some insight into this question really of, I think identity is part of it. I mean, this what it means to be British and become to regain sort of Britishness. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on how you see this? And then also, if you want to give us a window into whether you're happy to see this development or not.
I think Brexit is very much about that feeling that the European Union is the tail that wags the dog a bit, and that it has watered down or challenged national self-determination. So that really is part of the impulse. The kind of rhetoric you sometimes hear is what the Germans couldn't manage in the Second World War, they've managed through Strasbourg and the European Union. There is that's the more sort of right-wing case. There is a left-wing case about the European Union being very much a neoliberal institution, and that there is a sort of a socialist agenda for leaving, and that was sort of where Corbyn was more situated, and that was his downfall in the recent general election, partly his wishy-washiness on Brexit. Personally, I would have very much, I did, in fact, vote Remain. I do not think that... I do not know that whatever concrete problems there might be in negotiating things with Europe through the European Union, leaving it doesn't make things easier necessarily. I think it shuts down borders. Just at the moment when issues of climate and food and water, all the major economic issues going forward globally are global now. We can only answer certain things now, many things now globally, that we're all kind of pulling up the drawbridges locally. And that just seems to make things a lot harder.
Sarah, do you want to take a crack at that first?
Yeah, well, what I think about Brexit is that I used to work in the Citizens Advice Bureau, and I was really surprised at the law, which this was Tony Blair's fault, what he had done. And I think this is what was underlying in the North in respect of Brexit. So what Tony Blair had done is that you could come in from any EU country, and if you had a job, and you know, you only had to have that job, you could do the job maybe for 2 hours and you could maybe faint and lose your job or whatever. As long as you had a job one day, you had something called settled status. And when you have settled status, it meant that you could access all the benefits that British people, you know, access. So then the government had this austerity measure So it now decreased the money it gave people. So these are white people who've always been on benefits, you know, and their parents maybe were minors, you know, they live in council estates, whatever. And they're okay. They're kind of not happy, but they're getting by. So suddenly now the government has targeted them and it said, we think you guys are lazy. It's taken £30 a week off people who are disabled. It's started to charge bedroom tax. So if your kids leave home, if you had a council tax, they charge you for the extra room, so you have to leave. But then these people were now seeing Eastern Europeans who had come in with four or five kids, and they get a job and they leave the job the next day, and then they can get a council flat. And that was what caused the problem. It was the government causing, you know, there was a competition for resources at the bottom. And yeah, that's what caused Brexit. And it was Tony Blair's fault that he had this policy. So, and unfortunately, the Conservatives had austerity. There wasn't enough money. And people just thought, well, why is that Eastern European got a council house and my kids can't access council housing? We can't get benefits. And that's what happened.
Colin,
and now I think, whether you voted Remain or Brexit, I think that now we have to just do the best for the country, because it was a horrible 3.5 years. Mm. It was horrible, toxic. People stopped talking to each other. Families broke down. You know, my son wasn't talking to me. You know, it was a really, really big thing. So for me, I just want to like move forward. It's like, this is the decision. It was a democracy. You know, it wasn't a vote like in Africa where, you know, ballots were stolen. You know, then we had a second vote, and people went and voted Boris, you know, because he was doing Brexit. So we now have to give it a chance. That's how I look at it.
Okay, Colin?
I'm with Sarah on that. I always felt that once the vote went, it needed to be respected and implemented. Yeah. And after a lot of naysaying and the boy who cried wolf, eventually the electors, particularly the Northern Labour Party and South Wales voters, were willing to throw out Labour Party MPs that had represented their constituencies for 70 years. People had enough of it. I think that
just to get it done.
The paradox is, you know, when people say that Brexit is about looking inward and pulling up the drawbridge, actually I think that this fortress Europe, this whole idea that white people in Europe can create this perfect ideal society, and it can all be run by bureaucrats in Brussels, I don't think that's very progressive really at all. I think there could be a different way of looking at this, which is that Brexit might be about opening up more trade, for example, with the United States, with Canada. We live in a global economy now. You don't have to be right next to each other to trade, and you only have to look at the massive GDP of the People's Republic of China, which is now the second largest economy in the world, to know you don't have to be next door to be a major economic player. I think Britain's got really strong cards to play in a world market. And I think that there are going to be great opportunities that can come out of this.
Isabel, you want to add that?
I feel a little like it's a moot point, my opinion on it, because everything has already happened. You know, we're getting to the point where stuff will start to happen. All I have really is my own experience. I grew up in London, and the best thing about my world at that time, especially when I was a teenager, was access to mainland Europe. You know, it was this feeling of hopefulness, of difference, but interest in kind of cross-cultural stuff. I know you can have that without being part of the European Union, but being part of something bigger than just England, because it really felt like England. I didn't feel much connection to Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. Felt so important to me. So
you should have gone to a Catholic school, and you would have been surrounded by people from all over the world and hardly any English kids.
Well, my parents certainly couldn't have afforded a Catholic school, so that wasn't
a luxury. It was
free. It was?
Yes, paid for by the state.
Catholic
schools are free, and Church of England as well.
The Catholic school near me was not free, but I'm hearing that it was, there are free schools. Okay, well, I mean, that was true for my school also. You know, I went to a school where there were people from, we had a lot of refugees actually from Europe and from other countries. Same when I went to sixth form college, you know, Bend It Like Beckham, I went to a sixth form college in that kind of area, and I was very lucky to have, you know, so many different cultures. And then when I went to university, oh my gosh, bland. I had no idea. Nobody had said, you know, when you apply to university, try to look at it and see like what it's like. And it was just so many white people. It was awful. I didn't know why it was awful, but it was just white British people. It's not somewhere where I feel comfortable. And I'm not saying that, that Britain will lack diversity by not being part of the European Union. I think that's impossible now. But there's just a sadness. There's a sadness for me because it was something really useful.
I'm sad we don't have 2 hours with all of you. I've enjoyed this tremendously
Thank you.
With most of you, even Mark. So
it's nice to hear your voice again, Sarah.
Sarah, thank you.
And you too, Mark.
Sarah, thanks for taking the time joining us from London and here in studio. I kid because I love Mark Brummett, Professor of Hebrew Bible Interpretation at Colgate. Thank you.
Assistant Dean of Students now.
Oh, did I demote you?
No.
I've re-promoted. Thank you. I appreciate that.
The Dean of Students part was the demotion.
Oh, I see. Colin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
We'll see you and your wonderful work around Rochester. Isabel, thank you as well. Thanks for the perspective. More connections coming up on WRUR and on WXXI, Impeachment Hearings Live.